Today, June the 1st, 2019, we begin Series 42. Comprehensive Testimonial. In this series, we will see how yesterday's seals has comprehensively extended meaning for today. When I say yesterday's seals, you bear in mind that the trumpets are part of the seals. They're broadcasted in the seventh seal. But only in this way can both Moses and Jesus be revelations to witnesses to define who escapes their fire and brimstone that they've been empowered to cast upon those who seek to hurt them. Let us defer the revelation of the title of this study. We'll do so as we advance. Give me an opportunity to give clarification to the title of the series. What does comprehensive mean? Think of our educational experience. You remember, if you've gone to the university or to college, they'll give you maybe a 15-week course, and sometimes the final exam is comprehensive, and sometimes it's not, which means that all the subject matter that you've learned throughout the course of the 15 weeks, you're going to be tested on the final. But you've already taken two, three, maybe four tests in the interim. If the final is not comprehensive, those subject matters will not be included. Does that make sense? Good. Let's take, for example, math. The subject of mathematics is comprehensive. 2 plus 2 will always be 4. You didn't know that when you started third grade. Somebody had to tell you, with blocks perhaps, how to count and how to add. But that information has ramifications throughout your life. I'm 63, and though my mind is not as sharp, I still need to know what 2 plus 2 is, or 5 minus 3, or etc. It's comprehensive. Now, if you think back when you were in high school, they assigned you a locker, right? That was like 45 years ago. You go back to try to get into that locker, you're going to be arrested. Because your ownership is not comprehensive. They gave it to you, but it doesn't always belong to you. You may have bought a car today. You put new tires on it. Put oil in the engine. 10 years from now, when you buy a new car, that has no relevance to what you're driving. It's non-comprehensive. On the other hand, you go to the hospital and somebody gives you a kidney transplant, you expect to have that for the rest of your life. If you get it when you're 10, it'll have ramifications when you're 90. Let us relate the theme of comprehensive theology to the Bible. In theology, let me ask you, was the flood comprehensive? No. In the sense that we no longer are required to construct a literal ark in anticipation of a deluge. Its prophetic message was confined or circumscribed to that age. Ergo, we were given the rainbow. But with the trumpets and their description of the flood, it says in Revelation 8, verse 7, "And the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of the trees was burned up, and all the green grass was burned up." That's the first trumpet making reference to the flood. This first trumpet was coded in symbolism to describe its future reverberations today. And this is what this series is about. Reaching back into past prophetic revelations from the seals and the trumpets and manifesting how they are applicable for us today. No, we don't have to build an ark. No, we're not expecting a deluge. Therefore, the Lord wisely described the destructive force as hail. In actuality, it was water. The hail is made applicable to the eternal destruction of rebels. The fire mingled with blood depicts for us our need to evangelize sinners with the Holy Spirit-inspired work. evidence of this claim is found in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, verse 37. The Lord says, "But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." Verse 38. "For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." The Lord affirms that we need to know about the events of the flood so that we can understand the emergence of the Son of David. And it just so happens that the first trumpet gives us a depiction of the flood. Therefore, we can parlay with deeper understanding the imports of its truth and make them applicable to us today. We can do this now as we have embarked upon this new series entitled Comprehensive Testimonial. More illustrations may be required. I got a good one. Is the law comprehensive or circumscribed and confined? Now we are embarking upon a real issue that has been bantered about amongst Christians for nearly 2,000 years. Oh, we're no longer under the law, we're under grace. The seventh-day Sabbath was for the Hebrew people, as if they're the only ones that need rest. I guess a correlation in reasoning would be the law of adultery is for the Hebrew people as well. So you could understand by my preliminary comments that I believe that the law is comprehensive, and that the trumpets, in this case, the one that we're going to focus on, will give you a deeper understanding of how it applies to us today. But even if you access Paul's work, thinking that you can escape the need to comply with the law, let me just cite to you Romans chapter 8. Let's start with verse 3. "For what the law could not do, in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin condemned sin in the flesh." This means more to us today than it has ever meant, because we understand the two witnesses. We understand that the gospel is going to be finished by a combination of Jesus and Moses, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Why? Why should that be? Because the carnal mind is enmity against God. Enmity against God. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God. For it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. In other words, if there was any impediment to Israel embracing the law, it was because they walked after the flesh. And we saw in our last study, in Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 12, that when Jesus came, he condemned sin in the flesh, and by his knowledge, he afforded for many people to escape the penalty of the law. It says, "By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many," because he, Jesus himself, lived out the struggles and the experiences. And as a result, he will afford to many to have executive clemency. But I took you to Romans chapter 8 merely to show you that you can't even use Paul's work to show that we no longer have a requisite to be compliant with the commandments and with the law. Hebrews chapter 5 expresses a little bit more of this. Verses 12-14. For when the time ye ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. Now what Paul is telling you is that these people to whom he's speaking, the New Testament church, their aspiration should have been greater than just students. Their aspiration should have been that to be teachers. But they didn't qualify, according to Paul, to be teachers. Rereading, for when the time ye ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. You think we're going to study anything about those first principles today? I think we will. Because we need to be instructed on the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. For everyone that useth milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. It's a problem of our discernment. It's not a problem of the efficacy of the law. And that discernment was not made available to the students who limited their doctrinal discourse to New Testament era prophets, including Paul. He continues to say, therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on into perfection. Hence, Paul made his doctrinal discourse of milk to be non-comprehensive. Explaining further in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 8, charity never faileth. Now we have a new principle. He didn't say love. King James correctly interpreted them to represent this Christian emotion as charity. It never fails. He intended for charity to be comprehensive. But whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. Our Christological theology is going to vanish away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as also I am known. He says in verse 13, and now by the faith, hope, and charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. Charity is the concept that is going to be comprehensive. All those other New Testament concepts are going to be done away. It's like that college class course whereby the professor says that those things that you learned in the first three midterms are not going to be on the final. Well, that doesn't seem right. Well, no, those things make part of your grade. If you got A's on the first two midterms and you got a C on the final, those grades help you, whether they be comprehensive or not. The milk of the Word has elevated us to a point whereby now we can go on to glory. I like to use my space shuttle analysis. Remember the space shuttle? I think they've reverted to a different engineering now. But it used to be they had two, three fuel tanks on it called booster rockets. Booster rockets would take you to the upper limits of the atmosphere. Not far enough that you escaped Earth's gravitational tug, but far enough so that the space shuttle can detach from the booster rockets. They've exhausted their fuel. and can go on off to glory. So the booster rockets are those things that were done away. They're non-comprehensive. If you're traveling to Mars, or maybe Jupiter even, you're not going to look through your rearview mirror and be surprised because you don't have the booster rockets attached. But yet and still, they serve their purpose. I'm just trying to take a little bit of time so that we can understand in this first study the thrust of this Series 42 theme entitled Comprehensive Testimonial. Therefore, that's the mission of you as becoming a teacher. Your mission is to discern between those doctrines that are comprehensive and those that are circumscribed. Circumscribed, obviously, being non-comprehensive. But, Brother West, you teach that the testimony of Jesus is what's going to seal us. Therefore, it has to be comprehensive. Yes, indeed, it is. But the wisdom of the testimony of Jesus was hidden from our eyes to the point where the Lord says he's going to raise it up at the last day, acknowledging that it will be diminished and overshadowed, but the time is going to come when it's going to be the rock of our faith. How could that be? Because somebody, a teacher, will go back to the testimony of Jesus and therefrom show the church today the application of the Lord's teachings. Let us read Matthew chapter 7, verse 21 through 24. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works. Yes, but the test of that day, you need to discern whether it was comprehensive or circumscribed. And then I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them. You may have been empowered through the sayings of E.G. White, through the sayings of V.T. Hata, through the sayings of Paul to cast out devils. But the Lord said, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. That rock, as we learned, is Christ. That's his testimony. That's the sayings that he delivered to us. They have application for us today. They are comprehensive. It required the erection of that house 2,000 years of Christian history in the making. Therefore, it required a faithful builder who had charity, one who was willing to sacrifice his own popularity, his own efforts, his own blood, so to speak, and that I mean his arduous work, so that he could build the Lord's house. Matthew chapter 7 shows the countervailing, contrary, the flip side of this building effort. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man, which built his house upon the sand. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. They've had plenty of time, 2,000 years, to absorb the totality of the testimony of Jesus. Rather than building it on a firm foundation, on a mountainous edifice, they build it along the seashore, on the sand. And still, it became a great edifice. If it didn't become a great edifice, then you could not say great was the fall, right? Their work, their energy, and their efforts yielded for the world a great bastion. The only problem is they could not, in wisdom, discern those events that were comprehensive, those theologies and doctrines that were milk and those that were strong meat. This text, Matthew chapter 7, verse 26 and 27, shows that like the Tower of Babel, you can build a great house, but if it does not honor Christ, the great star from heaven, you will never receive freedom from gravity. By the way, our title to this study is, His Name is Wormwood. Could our struggles in this work be due to our slow recognition of this quality of Christ? Well, you need to know a little bit about wormwood to understand so that you can answer that question, but I think so. In Matthew chapter 7, they asked, Have we not prophesied in thy name? Let us as true witnesses read more on his name. Revelation chapter 8, and I'm reading verses 10 and 11. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And it fell upon the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. They were made bitter, 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 bitter. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. Lynette was just telling me this morning she was reviewing the Seventh-day Adventist teachings on the trumpets. And this one, the highest theologian in Adventism, Walter Veith, said this is a depiction of the devil. Therefore, if he's wrong and this great star is Christ, then no, you haven't prophesied in his name. You've called him a devil. It's folly to think that Christ is not the deliverer of bitter waters. Oh, no, only the devil can deliver bitter waters with this claim. Your theology in trying to understand Revelation is falsely hinged upon your ability to perceive what's negative and what's positive. Because it said bitter waters and many died, we think of that as being a negative. Therefore, we immediately want to protect Christ, whom we call Jesus. Oh, no, that's not him. He would never do that. We can't include that prophecy in our ministry because we want to uphold his name. In so doing, you're not prophesying in his name. The star is not evil. Today, we open a historically new dimension to our gospel. Like a healing herbal tea, Christ, not the devil, made the fountains of water bitter. For to sip it immediately yields isolation and reproach. That's your embitterment. Since this, the third trumpet pervades the Old Testament gospel light, its laws, the prophecies, allegories, the symbolisms, and statutes. And statutes! And statutes. Somebody missed that. Somebody glazed over that last one. It requires an echo. And since we honor those teachings today, we not only teach of the star comprehensively, but also only now do we truly prophesy in his name. He is symbolized by wormwood. This aspect of Christ now becomes our fountain of life. Before I elaborate further, let me just go to show more about prophesying in his name. You're familiar with this text, but we're going to approach it from a slightly different perspective, allowing you to even celebrate it all the more. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 11 through 14. And since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord tells thee, He will make thee an house. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name. For my name. For my name. He shall build an house for my name. and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. David goes to sleep. His son comes after him, and he builds a house for Christ's name. And the Lord promised to establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy, this is verse 15, shall not depart away from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. Therefore, we see that the son of David is going to build a house for the Lord's name. That could only be the house that we've read about in Matthew chapter 7. Whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And therefore, that servant who's likened unto a wise man, he's the one that builds the house that becomes invincible. Therefore, if you plan on eliciting the Lord's sympathy by saying all the wonderful things that you've done in his name, if you've rejected the Son of David, you have another thought coming. So, therefore, I say to the foolish men, the answer, again, is no. You have not prophesied in Christ's name. You may have fundamentally taught of Jesus. But to reject David's definition, he's the only one commissioned to so honor the Lord, is to violate the third commandment, the only mandate to fix our eternal station in the judgment, as prescripted by Exodus 20, verse 7. And I read, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain." That means there's going to be a day of reckoning. And all those who have had the name of the Lord revealed to them by this Son of David, whom we've come to know to be the Son of Man, all those who lackadaisically and hostily disparage those revelations about the name of the Lord, they are not going to be held guiltless. There'll be no executive clemency for them. Therefore, what the Lord has done these past 3,500 years since the utterance of the Ten Commandments is he has concealed the identity of the Lord. That's your clemency. He's hid it in Jesus until the mustard seed advances in the last day and unfolds to all the name of the Lord. But those who in that day rejected are not going to be held guiltless. Therefore, we can see even now that the star, the great star that came down from heaven, gave us a light, a burning light that was indeed comprehensive. It's applicable over the full span of church history. Now, let me ask you a question. Why did Israel rebel against Christ? In a nutshell, they hated his name. They hated the concept of wormwood. And I'll show you that in a second. They didn't take it in vain, but they hated it. Let us turn to Exodus chapter 15. Reading from verse 22 through 27. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days, how many days?
3 days.
And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Why did the Lord lead them in that direction if he knew he was taking them to bitter water? Because that's his name. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet.
Made sweet. Made sweet. Made sweet.
The waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them, and said, if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, and wilt do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all of his statutes, and keep all of his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that healeth thee. And they came to Elim, where were 12 wells of water, and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the waters. The Lord delivered them for 3 days so that they could make a trek to Marah. He knew that by the time they got there, they'd be thirsty. Therefore, if you don't appreciate bitter waters, then you don't appreciate Christ. Because he made Marah a statute. Marah was the path of Christ's prompting and his leadings. Let us make sure that that point settles in our mind. To rebel against that path with foreknowledge, no, don't go there, Moses, because those waters are bitter, would be to rebel against Christ. He wanted you to taste the bitter waters. That was the essential expression of his identity, his name. That's why it says his name was called Wormwood, for the waters became bitter. Not only does this show that we have a comprehensive obligation to honor this statute, which we'll expand upon as we advance, it was not circumscribed and limited to 3,500 years ago to the Hebrew church. Not only is that the case, but we see here why the place was called Marah. I like what it says here. It says, therefore, the name of it was called Marah. Gives you insight to what it means to understand the name of the Lord. Marah means bitter waters. That is a description of the place of their first settlement. Let none be confused, therefore, when the Bible promises David will build a house for his name. It's not talking about calling him Yeshua, or Yahweh, or any other name. It's talking about a description of his personality, which now we reveal is Wormwood. The name defines the characteristics. But think about this now. The journey to Marah was indeed purposeful. You're thinking, oh, I can glory in, and I can really resonate with the last 10 plagues. And I can appreciate Christ leading them through the Red Sea on a dry shod. And I could appreciate the rod of Moses in his hand. I could appreciate those things. Well, likewise, you have to appreciate the bitter waters. The Lord took them to the waters so he could show his water sweetener. You ever have a bitter herb tea? Put a little bit of honey in it. It'll go down easy. The tree sweetened the water. This represents Christ's tender provisions. But be it not mistaken, he still retained his name, Wormwood. We must comprehend its ordinance today. He is the only fountain in the wilderness to save. Subsequently, after bitterness, he gave us Jesus to sweeten his waters. So we don't have to call his bitterness the devil. All we have to do is recognize that he sweetens it so that we could ingest it with his tree. That was part of the statute. He gave Jesus to sweeten his waters. He put honey in their herbal tea. Then we shall receive what's next, our oasis, Elam. That's our kingdom in the wilderness. First bitter, then Jesus combined with Christ for sweetness, then Elam, our day of rest in the kingdom, our day of encampment. Thus it's illogical to have hatred for Christ. But some do. Exodus 20 verse 5. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Can you envision that there are people that actually hate the Lord? Now we can understand why they could fall to such a conclusion. They're unlike David. David said the law of the Lord is perfect. These are people who reject the bitter water ordinance. These are people that look at the laws and the prophets and all the episodes of Scripture and want to just disregard that path of discipline and just take the honey without the bitter waters. So if the church resists the singular man, the doctrine that the Lord is going to raise a singular man up to teach his testimony, to build his house upon a rock, if you resist that, if you become so cozy with your internal politics, so that you've got to have a vote, so that you've got to be able to scrutinize, and if the person does something that you don't like, you reach into their closet and pull out the skeletons and eject them out of office, then you're at war with wormwood. You don't like Christ's path of leadership. You think that you have a better way. In fact, you love the devil's way. You love the fact that you can think that you have control over the work by some form of democracy. But as we found out with the last election, the devil can come in and twist your democracy upside down. The Son of David is the overcomer that the Lord described in Revelation chapter 3. And he's the one that's going to elevate the church by enlightening them about Christ, by building a house for his name. And already you see some of this happening right now, because you understand that the bitter waters were made sweet through the Lord's statute. And it's what delivered you so that you could reach Elam. It's the path to peace. People hate Christ by hating discipline. They desire the scholastic degree without the school. They desire the smile without the braces. They desire the sex without the marriage. Health without cleanliness and diet. Rest without the Sabbath. Salvation without judgment, etc. The Seventh-day Adventist movement began this path of wormwood discipline. The waters at first are bitter. You think it was easy for E.G. White to validate the Saturday Sabbath doctrine when everybody else was worshiping on Sunday and isolate the people? It was the path of bitter waters. Do you think it was easy for her to elevate Leviticus 11, whereby people were saying that you're crazy if you don't eat swine? What about the state of the dead? They're still reviling Adventism because they say that we believe in soul sleep, which means, I guess, that you go into the grave until the resurrection. We believe the sayings of the Lord. She resisted the teaching of salvation without judgment. In other words, she resisted the teaching that upon death, your spirit goes off to heaven to be with God. And as a result of that, ignored Bible teaching. There was heaped upon Adventists of all type of unpopularity. Then she had the nerve to write Southern Works and showed that the Lord was going to extend help to the African Americans in the South and in the North that were entangled and entrapped in affliction and oppression. Man, those were bitter waters. Therefore, when the doctrine is unfolded to you, don't think about the bitterness. Look for the honey so as to sweeten it. Then that will allow for you to benefit from the tonic, the cathartic. The Seventh-day Adventist Church began this path of wormwood discipline. Now even they hate his meandering trail. It is a test of true manhood, for men are called to rule the beasts who reject their worm bills. I never had a dog, but I've seen on television whereby they try to give them a worm pill. You got to hide it and everything. They don't want the worm pill. And not just the dog, some of the other animals in the zoo. You know, you got to get a veterinarian to stick a pipe down some of their throats and drop the worm pill in their belly. But thank God he raised up a people that have ascended above the level of the beast of the field. People who have the self-discipline to drink the bitter waters. I refer you to the Song of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 39 through 41. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive. I've heard one minister say, no, that can't be Christ. He never kills. He does if you understand wormwood. I kill and make alive. I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and say, I live forever. If I wet my glittering sword and mine hand take hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to mine enemies and will reward them that hate me. I find it very interesting that he's only going to reward them in the judgment. But in the judgment, his water has been moderated by sweetness. This is the reason why Jesus is the only one that could take the book out of the Father's hands and examine all of those that are deserving of everlasting life and those who are not. And this is the reason why, as we read in Isaiah 53 in our last study, that it pleased the Lord to bruise him. It says, he was despised and we esteemed him not. And the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. It pleased Christ to bruise Jesus because he wanted to benefit from his knowledge, therefore, so that he could hone his arrows and his targets. He says, I will make my arrows drunk with blood and my sword shall devour flesh. He wants to destroy the wicked after they've been fully adjudicated and after it's been determined who deserves life and who deserves destruction. But he still issues destruction. If you reject Christ, then you reject Jesus. Because Jesus combined his gospel ministry with that of Moses. But I like the fact that he points to the day when the judgment will prevail. And that's going to be the day of his vengeance. Manifestly, therefore, and without a doubt, and without any equivocation, the star, the great star, that came down from heaven, whose name is Wormwood, who made bitter the waters, is comprehensive. And his shining light has benefit even for us today. It's only today that we've learned of the statute that makes his water sweet. Let me ask another question from another angle. Why lead Israel to bitter waters? Maybe somebody still doesn't get it. Why create all the drama, all the murmuring, all the complaining? Wouldn't it have been just easier to take them to Elam without the bitter water? It would be, but he wouldn't have a statute. But I still want to know, What was his strategy? He took them to bitter water because they came out of Egypt and were infected with worms. They needed to be purged spiritually. This is the lesson that the Lord wants us to absorb. When the gospel goes to the 144,000, these are people that are infected. They've got all type of devilry integrated into their theology. And they need some wormwood. They need something to purge them. A cathartic, you see, to clean up their act. And with the Son of David, he'll be able to give them their medicine. Because he'll be able to build a house for the name of the Lord. He'll be able to show that the Lord operates this way to lift you up so that he could take you in 3 days to Elam. That's not even to Palestine. But to Elam, our place of peace in the wilderness. This is why he needs leaders. What did Paul say? He needs teachers. Rereading. For when the time ye ought to be teachers, ye need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. But you can't be a teacher unless you do what? See, we're revisiting the first principles of the oracles of God. Just as Paul said, this statute, this path of wormwood discipline has never been worked into any theology.
Incontrovertibly then, our only path to mercy is
first bitter waters, then Jesus combined with Christ for sweetness, then Elam, our day of rest in the kingdom. Imagine if they had a communion cup that was full of wormwood. We don't do that. Back to one of our favorite texts, 1 Kings, chapter 2. Now the days of David drew nigh, and that he should die. And he charged Solomon, his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments, and his judgments and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that thou mayest prosper in all that thou doest, and whithersoever thou turnest thyself. The Lord has elected you, must receive the Adventist brethren, because he's appointed you higher. He has found a people, a collection of disciples, that are willing to keep the statutes of the Lord and to exalt his light and his truth. Therefore, in closing, I pose the question, what about us? The world's redemption comes with the sweet waters of Jesus and the bitter waters of Moses. The leaders must forego their coziness and charitably suffer bitterness to save humanity. They must love and teach the name of the Lord. All of us have drunken of the bitter waters. We would not be here if Christ did not give to us that tonic. Struggles with your friends, rejection by your parents, isolation by mom and dad, isolation by your church, trouble and betrayal in prior marriages, persecution in society, disabling sicknesses, etc. These travails have been installed to you for a statute and an ordinance by the great star of heaven. It has done what sweet waters could not do. It has placed you in the kingdom of heaven, not as a worm-filled rejecting beast of the earth, but as the men of dominion. Now you can forever anticipate your Elam, your oasis of peace and joy. For the allegory of the third trumpet is comprehensive, allowing you to celebrate the purging of your bowels with Christ. His name is Wormwood. And with that, I bring the study to a close.